What's up, Stitches? Welcome to So What, the podcast about historical needlework and those who stitched it, hosted by your gal, your pal, Isabella Rosner. This is the first episode of the podcast that's not connected to a season, so I guess I'll call it episode one of season whatever. I told you that the end of season three would not be the end of the podcast, and see, I was right. I made a promise, and here we are. I couldn't let down my fans. I'm kidding. That was cringeworthy to say out loud. Anyway, today's episode is an interview with independent textile and costume historian Lynn Zacek Bassett. We will be talking all about the exhibition Lynn curated, New London County Quilts and Bed Covers, 1750 to 1825, which is currently on display at the Florence Griswold Museum in Old Lyme, Connecticut. Lynn has made some groundbreaking discoveries about the needlework stitched by girls and women in the New London region of Connecticut, and we're going to learn all about them. It's a thrill, and I am not kidding when I say that for real. Oh my God, it's so exciting to me. As I say in the episode, identifying new groups of American needlework is really rare, so this is a super big deal. Before we get into learning more about Lynn and the exhibition, I gotta go over the good social media stuff. To look at images of the needleworked goodies Lynn and I discussed today, head over to So What Podcast, that's at So What Podcast, on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. All of the images and links will also be on our website, sowhatpodcast.com. Yay! Okay, now back to Lynn. Lynn Zacek Bassett is an independent scholar specializing in New England's historic costume and textiles. From 1995 to 2000, she was the curator of textiles and fine arts at Old Sturbridge Village in Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Since going independent, Lynn has undertaken a number of large projects, including curating an exhibition and catalog for the Mark Twain House and Museum and the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art, both in Hartford, Connecticut. In addition to several exhibition catalogs, Lynn has published books such as Massachusetts Quilts, Our Commonwealth, of which she was editor and primary author. Lynn was also the editor of Uncoverings, the annual journal of the American Quilt Study Group, from 2011 to 2017. Her contribution to the field of historic costume and textiles has been recognized by the American Antiquarian Society, the Massachusetts Historical Society, Historic New England, and the International Quilt Museum, which have all elected her to membership in their honorary or advisory societies. So clearly, Lynn knows her stuff. Lynn's most recent exhibition, and the reason we are here today, is, as I mentioned, called New London County Quilts and Bed Covers, 1750 to 1825, and is on display at the Florence Griswold Museum until May 1st of this year. So get there quickly, get there ASAP, time is of the essence. The exhibition description on the website reads, quote, "The domestic textiles produced in New London County from the mid-18th to early 19th century stand out today as masterpieces of American needlecraft. Curated by independent scholar Lynn Z. Bassett, New London County Quilts and Bed Covers, 1750 to 1825, on view February 12th to May 1st, 2022, examines the artistic excellence of these pieces within the context of design inspiration drawn from an array of transatlantic sources and explores the question of how the county fostered such exceptional work. Quilted petticoats with maritime motifs, bold geometric patterns on bed rugs, sophisticated feathers and fruit stitched on elegant whitework quilts, and patriotic appliques reveal the range and accomplishment of New London County women, whose names are only sometimes known, but whose textiles survive as evidence of the network of connections between teachers, students, and family members." End quote. I obviously live far from Connecticut, not obviously for those of you who have never listened to this podcast. I live far from Connecticut. I live in a different country. Anyway, because I live far from Connecticut, I cannot see the exhibition, but those of you who do live in the area, please go to the exhibition in my stead. There is good news for all of us who live far away from Connecticut, though. There's a virtual tour of the exhibition available on the Florence Griswold Museum website. I'll be posting a link to that on all the So What social media pages. Before we get into the interview, let me just quickly go over a few names mentioned in it. You'll hear the names Alden O'Brien, Linda Baumgarten, and Anne Marsh. Alden is the curator of costume and textiles at the Daughters of the American Revolution Museum, and it is through her that Lynn and I have met. And Linda Baumgarten is the former curator of textiles at Colonial Williamsburg and is now an independent textile consultant. Anne Marsh is somebody completely different. She's an 18th century powerhouse, a Quaker woman who taught needlework to the daughters of Philadelphia's elite for decades. She also designed a group of quilted petticoats. And I look at her a lot in my PhD work, which is why I brought her up and why she is surprisingly relevant in the discussion that Lynn and I have. Anyway, here's the interview. Lynn, thank you so much for being here today. I am really, really excited to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I'm delighted for my part.
Thank you. And special shout out to Alden O'Brien at the DAR Museum for making this connection possible.
Yes, thanks, Alden.
How did you come to be a textile and costume historian and one that studies New England's historic costume and textiles specifically?
That is a long story.
I'm here. I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
I grew up in Montana, not a New Englander.
Okay.
And I grew up on the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the Little House books. And I was fascinated by their manner of living and the costume, the clothing descriptions and all of that sort of stuff. So that's one factor. Mm-hmm. Another factor is that my mother could do anything with a needle, any kinds of
icon. Work. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And she bought me my first sewing machine when I was about six.
Oh, and, so young.
So I got trained up in needlework of various sorts from a young age. And I was very, very open to it. I remember I actually asked my mother to teach me how to embroider when I was about nine or so. So I grew up sewing, and then we moved to New England when I was 18, and I started school at Mount Holyoke. I went to Mount Holyoke for college. Coming to New England and being in all this much deeper history than you could get in Montana just blew my socks off. I was very excited by the history in New England. And at Mount Holyoke, I was also very excited by the exposure to art and being able to take an art history class. And I wanted to do everything. I wanted to do art history. I wanted to do history. I wanted to do literature. I couldn't settle into one thing. And so I became an American Studies major.
Interdisciplinary.
And that actually provided the perfect foundation for what I do now, because what I do now is I look at the big picture and use it as context for the costumes and other textiles and that sort of thing. Okay, so continuing this long story, I got out of college and I had already decided I really wanted to work in a history museum. And so I just started doing anything I could do. And fortunately for me, I also got married straight out of college, and my lovely engineer husband supported me while I did.
Ideal. You know, yes.
I did like four jobs, but they were each like 1 or 2 days a week. I just started working wherever I could. And because I knew how to sew, and I understood fabrics and cut and that sort of thing, I seemed to end up in costume collections because I was the only person on staff who knew what this stuff was.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate to have a mentor early on by the name of Nancy Rexford. And I worked with her to identify the costume collection at the Connecticut Historical Society. And she said, Lynn, you have an affinity for this. You need to get a master's degree. You need to join the Costume Society of America. You need to da 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 da. Mm-hmm. I did what she told me to do, and for better or worse, here I am. And I specialize in New England because that's the sort of stuff I can reach. You know, I'm here. I was the curator of textiles and fine arts at Old Sturbridge Village from 95 to 2000. And so that was an unbelievable grounding in New England history and textiles and costume and that sort of stuff. And then in 2000, I went freelance and there, see, I told you it was a long story.
I love it though. Can I ask the other part of the introductory who are you question? Okay. What shows have you curated? And I know there are lots because I did do like a little stalk of you before this. And I know you have been everywhere and done everything. So I don't need an exhaustive list, but I would like love to know what sorts of stuff you've worked with.
I have worked with flat textiles and costume from the 18th century to the 20th century to about the mid 20th century. My favorite stuff is from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. My favorite exhibit was Gothic to Goth, which I did at the Wadsworth Athenaeum in 2016, which looked at Romanticism's impact on fashion. And it's just such a fascinating period. There's so much going on. And I think that part of my attraction to it is how complicated it is, because there's just always something new to discover about it. And the fashions are just so much fun. They're just so much fun. They're crazy.
Yeah, they're so weird. And those are always my favorite time periods when things just got like super weird.
But then in the 1840s, they got so elegant. You know, that line, it's just so elegant. And so there's just always something really interesting going on in that period. And it was a beautiful show. And I loved making the connection to the 20th century and how goth fashion is rooted in gothic ideals.
I love that.
Of the 19th century. This is impossible. Okay, so another favorite exhibition was my Mark Twain exhibition.
Ooh.
Modesty died when clothes were born, costume in the life and literature of Mark Twain. That was my first major costume exhibition. That was really, really great. And there is a book, which I think you can still get, and I've got some if anybody wants one. So that one was really fun. And I fell in love with Mark Twain. But of course, my current exhibition at the Florence Griswold Museum, which is up until May 1st, is absolutely tied with Gothic to Goth. I mean, both of these I wanted to do for so long and was so fortunate to get the chance. And I'm so indebted to the Florence Griswold Museum. So this exhibition is called New London County Quilts and Bed Covers, 1750 to 1825. So it's not a costume exhibit. It's although there are quilted petticoats in it, 18th century petticoats. So it's still kind of a costume exhibit, and also flat textiles, quilts and applique bed covers and bed rugs. I've been working in Connecticut off and on for almost 40 years now. That first job that I had with Nancy Rexford was at the Connecticut Historical Society. And I just keep on coming back to the Connecticut Historical Society for one reason or another, either a job or research or something. I've been going back there for almost 40 years now. And when I was there, I right after I was the curator at Old Sturbridge Village, I decided to go freelance. Starting in 2001, I went to the Connecticut Historical Society as their costume specialist.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was there, I became refamiliarized with an 18th century quilted petticoat by Sarah Halsey. that's red wool, and it's quilted with a mermaid and lions and critters, and it's just the coolest thing. And I was like, well, what's the story here? And so I started looking into it, and I found more. And I was like, okay, there's a story here. And I wrote a little article in Piecework around about 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. And then I went and I did a quilt exhibition at Historic Deerfield, and they had one.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so that was part of it. And then also while I was at the Connecticut Historical Society, I became familiar with a couple of other quilts that were very unique. Very unique. Mm-hmm. And they're all from New London County, Connecticut. Plus, there are these amazing embroideries by Prudence Punderson and her mother, also named Prudence Punderson, because that's the way to do it in New London County.
Okay. Love it. Prudence is everywhere.
Anyway, it just seemed to me that there are these really, really interesting and unique and fabulous needlework items coming out of New London County. And so I just, you know, kept on thinking about it and gathering information in the back of my head for like 20 years.
What is New London? Like, it's obviously a county, but what was its vibe in the 18th and 19th century? Small town, little, like village, what kind of world were these stitching women in?
Well, that's exactly what the exhibition is about, is why did these amazing textiles come out of this one county? What was it about this county that fostered such amazing needlework? And London County is on Long Island Sound. Mm-hmm. It's bordered on the east by Rhode Island, and on the west, just in the town of Old Lyme, it's at the mouth of the Connecticut River, which runs up through the center of the state. And then the county kind of veers off to the east. So New London County is the whole southeastern corner of Connecticut. Okay.
Thank you.
So it has a really strong maritime heritage. It was a major international trade boat and shipbuilding, and then in the 19th century, it became a huge whaling industry center. And then inland, it was very successful, prosperous farming. They specialized mostly in beef cattle. And so, like, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but to some degree, they got through the revolutionary period a bit better than some other areas, because they were feeding the troops with beef. And so they were, you know, they were generating some income that other areas didn't necessarily have. But, you know, there are other periods when they suffered, like the town of New London in New London County was attacked during the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. And then Jefferson's embargo really damaged the county, because it cut off trade with Britain. So this is the background to these textiles. The quilted petticoats were done from the late 1740s to the early 1760s, judging by the dates that are worked in a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So this is the period of the French and Indian War, when the colonies are very, you know, they're still very strongly identified with England. Mm-hmm. And so a number of these petticoats have the British coat of arms quilted into them.
Classic. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And all of the petticoats have some kind of maritime feature. Some of them are quilted with full rigged ships. At least five of them have mermaids. They all have fish, turtles, you know, sea serpents, these crazy sea serpenty things. So they all have a maritime feature, which is very New London County. I mean, their economy is tied to maritime trade. Anyway, that's the background on those. And then you get into the bed rugs, which some of them are very tied to the Revolutionary War. We know that one of them, the maker of one of them, left a diary Her diary's in the collection of the Connecticut Historical Society, so we have a bit more context to it.
Nice.
But these bed rugs are all, you know, it really appears that they're all made entirely domestically, unlike the petticoats, which have the imported calamancos and silks and silk threads and stuff. Mm-hmm. The bed rugs are all domestically produced. They're spun from local sheep, dyed, woven, and embroidered by hand. And I think a number of your viewers may not know what a bed rug is.
Yeah, explain, please. Thank you.
A bed rug is a bed covering. It was the most common type of bed covering found in colonial America. And you could get one imported from ready-made from England, in which case they were woven with a supplementary looped weft. So mm-hmm. it's pulled up and looped, so it looks like a shag carpet. And that's where the term snug as a bug in a rug comes from, because
wait,
they're
really about,
yeah, bed bugs, oh. bed rug. Okay. That's where it comes from.
Oh, I'm having like a full crisis here in this chair.
No, right, it's an epiphany.
I love that. Yeah. That's okay. Amazing. Thank you. Wow.
So in New England, some women chose to make their own bed rugs, but they didn't weave them. They embroidered them. Mm-hmm. In the South, they wove them.
Right.
And up here, they embroidered them. And the distinctive feature of a bed rug is that the entire surface is embroidered. There is no background fabric showing. So it's not to be confused with the later embroidered blankets.
Mm-hmm.
A bed rug has the entire surface covered with embroidery, and they could be embroidered with a looped running stitch, which made them fluffy like a shag rug.
Yeah.
Or they could be embroidered with a flat darning or a flat mm-hmm. running stitch. So either way. So anyway, these tend to be strongest around the Revolutionary period and after, but they're all entirely domestically made. And so they're like, they could be interpreted as a point of patriotism, that we don't need you, England.
Right. Yeah.
We can make our own bed
rugs. Or our own country. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you get into the early 19th century, and there's this group of amazing applique bed covers. They're just one layer, so it's like a summer spread.
Mm.
They're applique with one fabric on a plain white background with these wonderful designs with a center medallion. One of them has this big tree, and it has a biblical passage about Jesus asking a farmer to save a fig tree that wasn't producing. And then the next one has the eagle, you know, the spread-winged patriotic eagle. Yeah. Okay. And then the next one has the three grapevines, which is the symbol of Connecticut and is on the Connecticut state flag. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all embroidered with black cross stitch with these biblical patriotic mottos and mm-hmm. the names and dates. And these had never been put together before. But again, you know, I found the first one when I was working at the Connecticut Historical Society. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. That is so different. I've never seen anything like that. And they're all dated between 1805 and 1808.
Oh,
okay,
wow.
So this is the period. So this is the period when Britain is harassing American maritime commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up with Jefferson's embargo that cuts off British trade and blah, blah, blah. So okay, so anyway, just think about that. All of these things are in this context,
mm-hmm.
historical and state and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so I found that first one at the Connecticut Historical Society. And then I was on Facebook, and a friend posted another one, the one with the tree. And I was like, oh my God, that looks just like the one at the Connecticut Historical Society. And the one at the Connecticut Historical Society is embroidered with the town, which is Montville, which is in New London County. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the one that showed up in New Jersey is embroidered with the town Montville. And it ended up in New Jersey because there's a Montville, New Jersey. But it's actually Montville, Connecticut. Okay.
I'm obsessed with it.
So that's how I found the second one.
Okay.
Well, then the third one, when I inquired about that second one, the third one popped up. I can't remember now exactly how, but through my friend Barbara Brackman. So she had the information on a third one, which was at the Henry Ford Museum. And I did the genealogy on these. There's two sisters and their niece made these. They're all from one family in Montville, Connecticut. And, you know, these things had dispersed all over, you know, halfway around the country. So those are in the exhibition now. And then the quilt that actually started this whole thing, like 20 years ago anyway, I went to an exhibition at the Florence Griswold Museum, and there was this really distinctive, it had to have been more than, it had to have been like 25 years ago. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
There was this very distinctive quilt from their collection on exhibition. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it was really unusual for them to put a quilt out because they're a fine art museum mm-hmm. dedicated to American Impressionism.
Right. Different vibe.
Yeah. Different. So anyway, so this was an early 19th century white work quilt stuffed with polka dots all through the background. Where have you seen that before?
That's so weird.
That gets filed away.
Yeah.
And then I'm working at the Connecticut Historical Society again after this stint at OSV. You know, I'm there as their costume specialist. And somebody gives a white work quilt with polka dots in the background to the collection. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. That's another one. Okay. So then in 2019, CHS asked me to do a quilt exhibition for them. Mm-hmm. So that was another great exhibit that I was really, really pleased to, and I'd been wanting to do for a long time because they have a great quilt collection. So anyway, I put this polka dot quilt out. Well, our friend Alden caught wind of it. And she said, hey, we've got one of those in our collection. So three. And so I asked Alden to draw motifs from her quilt on Mylar and mail it to me. And she did that. And I took it to the Florence Griswold Museum so I could lay it on top of their quilt to see how close the match was mm-hmm. of the patterns. And I couldn't do it with the CHS quilt because it was on exhibit in a display case. So I was at the Flo Griz, and that's how this whole thing started. I started talking to them about, isn't this interesting that all these interesting textiles are coming out of New London County? And nobody's ever pulled these together before to see what's going on.
So fascinating. First of all, congratulations on having this show that is like putting together all of your disparate thoughts over the course of decades. That is amazing. One of the things I find so interesting, and I just love it, about all the textiles that come from this region are this, it's this thing of, they're very connected to the world, to the rest of the world mm-hmm. through their maritime conquests, right? So they're bringing in these motifs that are, you know, not only related to the sea, but also related to like what people in Britain were stitching with all of those mermaids and ships and, you know,
right,
all of that stuff. But at the same time, all these women, presumably, we'll get into it, are making these textiles at a time where, the region they're living in is going very rapidly back and forth between being like, we're part of Britain. No, we're not. Actually, we're not part of anything because we're currently like in an embargo situation. All of these kind of fluxes and changes that seem to lead to this really unique textile tradition of something that is so ingrained in the textile traditions of elsewhere, but turned completely on their heads to make something so unique.
Yeah, very regional.
I'm so drawn to those textiles that are of the world, but like they have clearly taken their inspiration from something greater than themselves. But through various circumstances, the makers have turned these things into something completely unique. And you can figure out exactly where they were made and when and by who and why. And that sort of world building that comes with
being able to establish connections between unique textiles is just the best. I think that it speaks so beautifully to the power of human ingenuity and the power of one or just a few individuals to take what they see and drastically change it. That, you know, several hundred years ago, somebody was like, could I just put some polka dots in here? And, you know, now you were like, wait, there's one over here and there's one over here. And that was just a creative choice that somebody made. And that single choice has allowed you to, has fueled the fire to rebuild the world in which they lived. I think that speaks so beautifully to like the joys of textiles being a mix of kind of like what you know, but also what you want to see.
Well, they give such an opportunity to think both narrowly and broadly. Mm. I mean, you can think about them in the household, but then you can also think about them in the context of the wider world. And there's such an important way of thinking about women's history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they left so few written documents themselves. You always have to come at women's history, as I keep on saying, sideways.
Yeah.
You right. know, you come at it through their husbands, fathers, sons, brothers, like, whatever. And you come to it through the stuff that they used, the stuff that they made. And another thing that's important to understand about New London County is that it's prosperity in the 18th century led it to also be the region of the state with the highest level of enslavement. And so we have to think about what's called the hidden labor behind these textiles. And it's not all necessarily enslaved labor, but there's a lot of household help that can be afforded by women in, you know, middle and upper classes that allow them the time to make this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And right, and while we can't know for sure if any of that labor took stitches in these, but it's just important to recognize that these aren't done by just one person. I mean, they may have stitched it along, but they had help and support somehow in the background that gave them the time to do this.
That's so true. And that's hugely important to say. So thank you.
So yeah, so the opening image in the exhibition is a very famous embroidery by Prudence Punderson Rossiter. The first, second, and final stages of mortality, mm-hmm. which probably everybody knows. It's like the most famous embroidery in America.
It is amazing.
And there's a black servant
right
in that embroidery. So I just want to
thank
recognize
you.
Yes. that aspect there.
I really appreciate you saying that because it's true. Behind these women whose names we know are people who are even more difficult to access.
Right.
The records. Prudence Punderson may have put her name on this piece of stitching and may have done the stitching by herself, but the only reason she did it was because of the labor of many, many countless individuals whose work wasn't recognized. So thank you. Yes. So I have heard that there is a big discovery you made about some 18th century quilted petticoats from New London. I'm really excited to hear about this because quilted petticoats are like a pretty major deal in the 18th century in colonial America and other parts of the world, but I've never talked about them on the podcast.
Oh.
So extremely exciting new subject matter and deeply close to my heart because I am currently researching Anne Marsh, who was also, so she was also deep into the quilted petticoat lifestyle. So yeah, right. Please.
And are you familiar with Linda Baumgarten's research on Anne?
No, I am. Okay. Yes.
So anyway, okay. So Linda has done a lot of research on the designs of these petticoats. And I am grateful this opportunity right here to say I'm indebted to Linda for sharing her drawings and information with me. I mean, we've shared information back and forth for 20 years. But her drawings are in the exhibition of the petticoats so that we can really see the patterns. So okay. Linda gave me the drawings for these petticoats. And I used those to understand the patterns, et cetera, et cetera. But in the process of tracking down these petticoats, and as I said to you, I kept on bumping into them. When I was in another one of my freelance positions, for 10 years, I was the acting curator for costume, fashion, and textiles at the Wadsworth Atheneum Museum of Art in Hartford, which is where I did Gothic to Goth. And when I was there, I found another one of these petticoats, but a fragment of a petticoat. Well, it turns out the record said there's another fragment at the Yale University Art Gallery. The petticoat at the Wadsworth Atheneum had the history of belonging to the wife of the governor of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. The fragment that was at Yale had the history of belonging to Mary Fish of Stonington. Both of these women were the great-grandmothers of the donor of the petticoat to Yale.
Aha, okay.
But the one from Wadsworth came from, you know, like another step away. Mm-hmm. Looking into the genealogies, it actually made sense that Mary Fish was the owner, was the maker of that petticoat. The one at the Wadsworth Atheneum was too young. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So Mary Fish is very well known. There's a book about her called The Way of Duty. They made a movie about her. There's just tons of documentation because of family letters and such. Well, I knew Mary Fish from years back, and I had that book on my shelf. And I went and I pulled out the book. And from that book, I learned that she went to the school of Sarah Osborne in Newport, Rhode Island. And then I'm like, Oh, wow. Okay. I have the name of school teacher here because I think these petticoats are coming out of a school or are somehow associated with a school, just like the Ann Marsh petticoats.
Right. Right.
Are associated with a school. Okay. Really? So it's similar there. There's a parallel. Okay. So then I go to my Betty Ring, the sampler, the late sampler expert, and I pull out my books about American samplers by Betty Ring, look up Newport. There's Sarah Osborne. You look at the samplers, the same designs in the samplers that are in the petticoats.
And can you tell me briefly what those designs are? Like what kind of things you're seeing?
Well, Betty Ring calls the samplers attributed to the Sarah Osborne school the frolicking people samplers because they're people.
That's so fun.
And there's almost identical sort of people on these petticoats, you know, women with fans and men with cocked hats and, you know, this sort of thing. The same sort of critters show up in these in the samplers that you see. You don't see the mermaids, but you see the critters. I mean, the petticoats have a real maritime theme that you don't, see in the samplers. But there's all these other parallels. There's also, there is sometimes this large central flower in the middle of these samplers. And you see those in the petticoats, in a few of the petticoats. So, you know, I totally admit that this is all circumstantial, but okay, we know that one of the makers went to her school. There's a lot of crossover in the designs, and all of the petticoats that have dates fall within the period that Sarah Osborne was working in Newport.
That is so cool. And I should say right now for So What listeners that like discovering and like even with circumstantial evidence, basically discovering a new group of schoolgirl textiles, especially in America, is rare and difficult because a lot of that territory has already been tread. And if it hasn't, there doesn't seem to be a lot, like enough information to really figure stuff out. So the fact that you did it, I just need to impress upon people that it's not a really freaking big deal. And that like this, a kind of schoolgirl group discovery of this scale hasn't really been done since Betty Ring in 1993, 29 years ago. So huge congratulations. That is amazing. We have lots of questions.
Well, the thing that's so cool is that this is another more evidence of how New London County was tied to Rhode Island and to Newport.
Totally. You know,
it's this cultural mix. These New London County textiles, especially the bed rugs, when you see them mentioned in literature, or whatever, they're often attributed to the Connecticut River Valley. And one of my goals is to show that this is not the Connecticut River Valley. New London County is its own culture. It's its own area. And it's more tied to Rhode Island than it is to the Connecticut River Valley. And so I'm looking at furniture and you know, scholarship that has been tread before.
Mm.
And the same thing, there's this, what's called the Stonington group of Connecticut furniture. Stonington is like where so many of these bed rugs come out of. And the researchers of this Stonington group tie it to Newport. And what is so interesting about these Stonington furniture that makes people go, oh, that must be from Stonington. It's the little curly cues on the feet, on the bracket feet of this furniture. And what is it that's so distinctive about these New London County bed rugs? It's these curves, these curly cues that go around the border of the bed rugs. So, you know, I'm just trying to cast my net very broadly to bring in as much information for my argument as possible.
So Sarah Osborne, do you know anything about her? Have you been able to figure out anything?
Like, she is another very well-known person. Her diary's been published.
Oh my gosh.
Her correspondence with Mary Fish's father is what, you know, grounds all of this stuff. The thing with Sarah Osborne that's so frustrating is that she was a very, very pious woman, very religious, very significant in her community for religious thought. And her correspondence typically is all about religion. There's just these little bits here and there about teaching school. Little bits.
This is the struggle I have with the Quakers that I'm looking at for my PhD. Like, they produced so much stuff and we have it and we know it, but they were never, ever, ever writing about it. And if they were, it was like, hey, can you pick up some silk? And I'm like, that's
right.
The least helpful thing. So right. I understand.
So the great little tidbit, though, that comes out of this correspondence is that she does talk about doing the drawings for the embroidery patterns herself.
Oh my God.
That's the embroidery that she never mentions quilting. So, you know, we don't have our smoking gun.
Fascinating. It is that really interesting thing that comes up when you think about kind of schoolgirl needlework in America and in other parts of the world, like how much was made in the classroom and how much of it was these girls who turned into women taking this style and using it in their adult lives.
Well, that's the thing with the crewel work. It's like, right. Were they seeing these petticoats? Did they attend the school? I mean, there is a petticoat that has lost its history, but it's embroidered with the initials PG. Okay.
Is it another Prudence?
Prudence Gear, whose valances are in the exhibition that are practically a match to a different, but another one of these quilted petticoats. Is the PG Prudence Gear? We'll never know.
Right. You know, wow. Wow. To be a girl in New London County, you actually were only allowed to be named Prudence. Any other name, they were like, you actually can't be here anymore. You got to move. It's only Prudences. Okay. Before
I'll tell you, working out the family genealogies.
I can't even imagine. I cannot even imagine.
I mean, when we get
generation after generation of Prudences.
When we get into the bed rugs, the repeated names.
Well, yeah. So tell me about the bed rugs.
The bed rugs. I'll focus on one design group because we have the most information about it. The exhibition includes three design groups that are very distinctive to New London County, but there's this one design group that I call the Pot of Flowers with reverse curve vine border or something like that.
Cute. Yes.
Okay. So that, and first of all, I did an inventory of every known American embroidered bed rug. And I came up with 63 examples, which is like at least 20 more than were ever known before, which is cool.
Congratulations.
But then looking at their origins and thinking, you know, grouping them by known makers and known origins and, you know, bringing in stylistically similar or the same, you know, creating groups like that, like half of American bed rugs come out of Connecticut. It might even be half come out of New London. I think it's half come out of New London County. And within New London County, within New London County, this group is the best known. It's 16. So 16 out of 63 is this one design group. And they come out of three towns in the northwest corner of New London County. So it's very specific location. And when you get into the families, into the genealogies, they're like all related practically. So there's clearly...
What the heck was going on?
Inspiration passing from family member to friend to neighbor within this very tight community. And the first four in this design group come from what's called the Foot Design Group. They all are believed to relate to a wedding that occurred in 1778, a wedding that married four couples in one day, one marriage ceremony, four couples. So it's this mingling of the Foot and Otis families and a couple others. Anyway, and so you see these names come up over and over and over again. But anyway, the first four are from Colchester. And they're blue and white, and a couple of them are brown, blue, and white, and they're done with a flat darning stitch. Very distinctive. Okay, so those are the first ones from the 1770s. Okay, so the next that are the same overall design, but they're like earth tone colors. They're kind of faded. They used to be brighter, but it's a different colorway. It's the same design, different colorway. They start showing up about 15 years later. And they're in Lebanon and Basra, which border Colchester, but they're not Colchester. They're Lebanon and Basra over here, okay? So whoever, did Elizabeth Foot design that? Because we have her diary, and from her diary, we know that she was drawing quilt patterns for her neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Classic.
And Elizabeth marries the minister from Lebanon. The minister's mother is a Metcalf, which connects to all these other bed rugs. But does Elizabeth move to Lebanon? No. When? She moves to Marlborough on the other side of Colchester. So she's not in Lebanon and Basra. I think it's a true ratio of origins of these bed rugs. I think Connecticut really was the hotbed.
They were just churning
of bed rug, and it was a cultural thing in that area, especially. And I think there were these family connections that nurtured the idea that, oh, I need to have a bed rug that I embroider myself from yarn that I've spun and dyed myself.
So interesting. Also, something very cozy and kind of lovely about the idea that it's bed rugs. It's this thing that, like, I've been thinking a lot about bed rugs recently. It's this, you know, fairly uniquely American thing. And it's not exclusively, but the way that it is produced in America, you're not really getting it produced elsewhere. And it's this thing that brings warmth and comfort and identity at a time when these people were going from being colonies of Britain to being part of a new burgeoning country. And right. I find there's something really wholesome and like humanizing about the fact that this is the thing. I mean, obviously there were other things, but when it comes to New London at this time, when it comes to this specific kind of textile, people were seeking physical comfort and identity through that comfort.
Pulling this together,
it's amazing.
During COVID, was a real challenge, And I want to say again how grateful I am to the staff of the Flow Grizz for not losing faith, and for just handling the logistics. Mm. Items for this exhibition literally came from around the country. I mean, from Los Angeles, from Washington, D.C., from Virginia, from Detroit, they had to bring these in from all over the country. Very few museums could do that. But we also had a number, because probably due to COVID, we had a number of loan denials.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so I am so grateful to the people who did loan. I can't even begin to tell you the people who scrambled to make loans on short notice when something that we were hoping for was denied. Mm. I am grateful to the Flow Grizz, like I said, for not losing faith, and friends like Alden who shared their information.
We love it. Thank you to the Florence Griswold Museum and to Alden O'Brien and to all these institutions that were willing to lend objects and that have their objects online. We love accessibility and we love collaboration.
Yes.
And I think interestingly, the exhibition is a testament to that having been done in COVID, but also to collaboration amongst all of these women 250 yes. years ago.
Yeah. It's all big bunch of collaboration.
So I have a big question. It's always the question that people hate, but I love to ask because I don't have to ask myself the question, which is, what is your favorite textile object or objects?
I love costume. I love flat textiles. I love embroidery. I love quilting. If you really put my feet to the fire, I would have to say that my very favorite sort of textile object is actually something I've never even been able to do an exhibition on. But I get to tap into it and maybe more. It's crewel work.
Mm. That's a good one. Thank you for letting me hold your feet to the fire. Crewel work is, and I appreciate
it. Well, it ties in to so many things.
Yeah. And it's so, it picks up on it picks up on trends, kind of like aesthetic mm-hmm, trends mm-hmm, in a way mm-hmm. that other forms of embroidery haven't. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate you saying it because I've basically never talked about crewel work on the podcast. And so maybe I'm going to do a whole episode on crewel work. So thanks for the inspiration. What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
I know that it saved my sanity in 2020. Mm. Sitting and stitching and just the comfort of sewing, of embroidering, whatever, knitting, whatever floats your boat, the comfort of being creative. I think needlework has forever, for many women, not all, many women and men too, mm-hmm. been a tremendous comfort, especially in times of trouble. The other way that needlework is so important is the expressive ability of it. The way people, like the Tiny Pricks Project,
example,
and that and so many other ways that people are able to express their emotions, their political views, their values. I think it's a very powerful vehicle for expression.
Finally, how can people learn more about your work? And do you have anything you'd like to promote? I have a feeling you do, and that this thing is the exhibition, but there's probably more, so give it all to me.
Well, of course, I want to promote the exhibition. It is only up until May 1st.
Get there fast, everyone.
You got to get there soon. It's such a unique opportunity to see these textiles that all started in this county. They're back where they started, but they have dispersed all over the country. And there aren't many museums who can bring all of these things together again. So I don't know when this is going to happen again. So do see it before May 1st. There will be a book.
Will there? Year. Oh, my voice got
We are going to follow up with a book. Yay.
Yay. Huge yay.
And so hopefully I'll be able to dig into these questions that I either couldn't get to because we pulled this together during COVID and I couldn't get into libraries and collections.
True. Yeah.
Some more things have come to our attention now that this stuff is out.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's going to be great. It's going to be a great book. We're going to hopefully have a couple of other collaborators of very impressive credentials. On Instagram, I'm Lindsay Woolsey, spelled LynnezWoolz.
Truly single-handedly, you have lifted me from my COVID stupor. Aww. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure. Believe me. Thank you.
Hello, me again. What a delightful, jam-packed interview. Thank you to Lynn for telling us all about the rich, interconnected world of New London needlework. I don't think there's really been this much work done on and discoveries made about an American needlework group since Betty Ring published her book Girlhood Embroidery in 1993. So yeah, it's huge and super exciting. Lynn's discoveries highlight one of the best parts of studying historical needlework, at least in my opinion. There is so much centuries-old needlework in the world, and not that many people studying it, so there's a huge amount that is still unknown, still mysterious. That means that every day of studying old needlework is gloriously like being a detective. There's a lot of following clues and piecing together pieces of information and establishing narratives, which is the best. I mean, maybe that's just me, but I think it's the best. All of this needlework is out there waiting to be rediscovered. All of these historic stitching folks waiting for their stories to be told once more. And what a super rad, beautiful thing that is. And that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening, and I will be back sometime soon. Very soon, I think. Thanks for sticking around. Now go out and stitch some stories, and like the women of 18th century New London County, go name your daughters Prudence. Bye! Thank you.